It is my great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Ronald G. Knapp. Professor Knapp comes to us from New Paltz, New York, and is SUNY Distinguished Professor of Emeritus in the Department of Geography at State University of New York at New Paltz, where he taught for 33 years. Professor Knapp first carried out field research in Taiwan in 1965 and 1966, and in the mainland beginning in 1977. Over the past 42 years, he has lived and traveled widely in East and Southeast Asia with more than 50 research trips, mainly in China's rural countryside. His early research focused on the process of Chinese pioneer settlement of Taiwan, especially the extraordinary reshaping of landscapes by human efforts as Han Chinese migrated into frontier regions. In 1980, he edited and contributed to China's Island Frontier, Studies in the Historical Geography of Taiwan. Over the past three decades, Professor Knapp has published 14 books and numerous articles on various aspects of China's cultural and historical geography, including walled cities, bridges, villages, and vernacular architecture. His most recent books include China's Covered Bridges, Architecture Over Water, and Chinese Dwellings, the Architectural Heritage of a Nation, both with photographs by A. Chester Ong. He's also the contributor of three chapters and co-editor with Kai-Yin Lo of House, Home, Family, Living and Being Chinese, Asia's Old Dwellings, Tradition, Resilience and Change, China's Old Dwellings, China's Walled Cities, China's Living Houses, Folk Belief Symbols, and Household Ornamentation, as well as seven earlier books on China's cultural and historical geographies. Professor Knapp has also been extremely supportive of young scholars in the field of Chinese architecture, myself included. In addition to reading and reviewing new manuscripts, he has recently become the co-editor of a new book series through University of Hawaii Press, Spatial Habitus, Making and Meaning in Asia's Architecture, each volume of which will be published in both English and Chinese. Professor Knapp stands as an example to us all of how much one person can accomplish with hard work and dedication to a field. At Vanderbilt, he has graciously agreed to deliver two lectures, the first of which is tonight's lecture, entitled The Business of Tourism in China, The Conflict Between Historic Preservation and Profit. Please join me in welcoming Professor Ronald G. Knapp.
Thank you very much, Tracy and Ray. Can you hear me? If I don't get behind the microphone there, that was a very generous, did you leave anything out? I don't know.
Well, yes, I did.
You probably did. Thank you very much. I've had a wonderful career. Went straight from graduate school to retirement at one institution with plenty of time to travel, live, and carry out research in China. And one of the topics that I've increasingly become interested in is tourism, but also historic preservation issues. It's a very, very complicated topic, a very large topic, large and complicated by and large because China is large and complicated. It's difficult to generalize easily about the topic. And I think if there were some others giving this talk with this title, they might take a totally different tack. But my tack tonight is going to be outside the cities in China. Now, I suspect that many of you have, most of you, if not all of you, have traveled to China, probably been in cities, some rural areas. And I'm actually going to focus on one rural area. Let me get there in just a minute by a somewhat circuitous route. It was in 1987, just 20 years ago, after having visited literally hundreds of villages all over China, as I say, freely and for free, I was out in the countryside in a very remote area, and as I was entering the village, I had to buy a ticket. Now, that was something new. That was something new for me 20 years ago, and there was no way for me to look ahead and see where this was going. But it began to set me to see some things that were happening. And I would say, in recent years especially, I visited now scores of villages, some of them fairly well-known, some of which you may have visited as well, but some of them even more remote than the one that I went to in 1987, where somebody was sitting under a tree selling a ticket. I want to look at this a little bit here. These actually are the two tickets. I don't throw anything away. I just happened to put those away. We'll come back to these a little bit later, but these are the tickets from 1987. There's not anything in there that clearly is appealing to foreigners. Now, in fact, one of the villages up here is shown here is the South Lake scenery, so to speak, has nothing to do with the village. All of this is going to change in the subsequent 20 years, and as my narrative here develops. Now, more recently, and those of you who have been in the Shanghai area, you may have had an opportunity to visit some of the water towns that are outside. There's an assemblage of six of them here that have emerged over the last 10 years, and then there's one here that's actually in the suburbs of Shanghai, Zhujiazhou, which is certainly worth a visit, well-publicized, well-traveled to, but sort of outside these six that are there, that are on the brink of UNESCO World Heritage status. Whoops. But in addition to that, in that region, there are a couple other small villages. If any of you have been to any of these, sort of give me some sense that you've been to some of these. Which one, Ray?
Zhejiang.
Oh, you've been to Zhejiang?
This one.
The top one, the Lujer?
Xinjiang.
Oh, you mean up here?
Yeah.
Well, Jiangnan actually is the regional term. That's there, and the two,
whoops. I think it's the bottom right.
The bottom right, the Wujun.
Yeah.
Okay. These are not as popular yet. They're on the cusp of popularity.
You had to buy a ticket.
Pardon me?
You had to buy a ticket.
There are backdoor routes into most of these villages. And in Shanxi province is another one that's not yet well visited, but this is a remarkable, wonderful place to visit the Wangjia or the Wang family manor. Who's been there?
Where is it in Shanxi?
It's in about 100 kilometers south of Taiyuan. If you've been to some of the village, if you've been to some of the manors in Shanxi, like the Chaozhou Manor, the Chao family manor,
yes.
Yeah, they're more popular. They're closer to Pingyao. These are farther south, and there are a whole bunch of these that are on the cusp of being discovered. Anybody been here? This is a real find. This is a place called Chuandisha, outside of Beijing, about 100 kilometers west of Beijing. It's worth a visit. You can sleep there, spend the night, sleep on a kong. There, it's really a very, very interesting place, and there's my ticket. In addition to that, this is one that I visited first in 1990 when they weren't selling tickets. This is in the southwestern part of Fujian province. This one here is now being examined very, very carefully for UNESCO World Heritage status. And my inside information is this is likely to make it next year for a variety of reasons. But these are extraordinary structures here. Now, we have to ask ourselves, really, right here, what has happened over the past decades to transform places of residence and work for rural folk into a commodity to be consumed by tourists from near and far, as well as what are some of the impacts of these changes in terms of inviting tourists into the villages. And the talk that I have this evening, I want to sketch briefly the scope and character of China's tourism industry. There are some elements of it that those of us in the West don't understand. We want to explore some of the contending forces that have accompanied modernization efforts in rural China that have led not only to the massive demolition of old houses and other historic structures, even complete settlements, but also the transformation of many of them into heritage sites. We also want to look at some of the reasonably successful efforts. And I specifically want to do this because our newspapers are only filled with all of the messes that are out there. In the current issue of Far Eastern Economic Review that just hit the newsstands yesterday, just hit the website yesterday, there's a chapter in there by a fellow I know quite well, and the section is called Preservation Destruction, and the whole intent is to show how everything's being destroyed, and we get that story all too often. We also want to see what are some of the persistent and intractable threats that exist. They're real, and as a result, there is persistent and intractable destruction often that accompany these threats. And we're going to do this basically by focusing on one of the areas I think is the most beautiful in China, and that's the area called Huizhou in southern Anhui province. Anybody been to, you've been there? You've been to Huangshan. We'll put the Huangshan.
Yixian.
You've been to Yixian. Okay, then you're going to see some images here that will help you recollect some things. Now, tourism indeed is booming in China. And in fact, I've never been in these masses like this, but these are pictures taken in May 2006 and May 2007 in the Forbidden City area, coming to enjoy the scenery, enjoy the crowds and the like during the May Day holidays, when it said there are 150 million people on the move. That's half the population of the United States on the move. And of course, this is more than about 15% of China's population on the move. But tourist sites very often are like this in China. Now, some of you perhaps have actually been to some of these sites when there were these kinds of crowds. Most of them I went to early and often was there all by myself. The Great Wall, the bridge at West Lake there, one of the Jiangnan water towns here, and of course the Sichuan Water Park. We'll say something about some new forms of tourism in China as well. Now, some of us also have been lucky along the way to have been in central or western China or in the mountains, where in effect it seems if China was underpopulated. Now, let's move to some numbers and get some feel for China in terms of what's happened to the tourism industry specifically, even looking at industries specifically in China. Now, whenever you're using any data concerning China, it's basically suspect. It always, sometimes it's town, you know, to four points after, or four places after the decimal point, which should make you even feel even more suspicious about it. I use Chinese data in aggregate, sort of to get a sense of a pattern. Typically the patterns are there. So don't really pay too much attention to the vertical axis here. Do pay some attention though, the numbers are right. The years are right, 78 to 2003 across the bottom. But what we see here, this is supposed to be GDP by sector, 1978 to 2003. And we see here in the bottom with the green, essentially the agricultural sector, the forestry sector, animal husbandry, and fisheries. At one point, it was a major component of the Chinese economy. It's continued to grow, but it's those other two sectors, the manufacturing, the construction sector, of course, that is swept up and become so significant, as we know. And then, of course, there is the tertiary sector, the service industry, the banking, the education, insurance, things of that sort, but also including tourism. Now, just look at that just sort of broadly here. We can see in 1978 that there was a manufacturing sector, there was a tertiary sector in there, but I don't think anybody had any real sense of exactly what it was. But I will tell you, in 1978, the only component of the tourism sector was tourism related to foreign tourism, the arrival of foreigners who came to China. Now, if we focus on 78, we look at 1987, and then we move ahead to 1997, we can throw in a few words here. Now, let me just see if I had a point here I wanted to make. Those in essentially 10-year increments begin to tell the story. We look at this, drill down a little bit more here. We can see how agriculture proportionally has decreased as manufacturing has increased, service sector has increased, but it's had its ups and downs here. But as we well know, in terms of China, that it's that construction sector, you know, that has led us to see the crane, the building crane, as the national bird of China. You know, any tour that you're on in China, that's one of the first things a guide will tell you. I used to be very impressed, but the more time now I spend in New York City, it's kind of the national bird in New York City as well. It may be the national bird here as well. Construction is booming all over the world, forcing up all types of the prices of all kinds of commodities. But let's look here at some tourism numbers, or as the Chinese early on called them, visitors. Now the visitors numbers from 79 here to 2006, we see a little more than 4 million here, 22 million, 51 million, 125 million. It's clearly increased quite significantly as the decades go by. Part of the story is not told here, but we'll see this in just a moment. This says, besides Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan. I'll factor that in with the next slide. But what may come as a surprise for some of you is that in the year 2000, the year 2006, that it was Japanese, South Korean, Malaysian, and Russian tourists that really formed the bulk of the foreigners who came to China. And then Americans were kind of down their way. We'll see two slides down the road that'll show this a little bit more clearly. Often when we're in China and we see tourists, we may assume they're Chinese tourists, but very often they are Asian tourists. In fact, there was a blog in the New York Times just two or three days ago where somebody was responding to an assertion somebody wrote concerning the fact that Shanghai is not a very cosmopolitan city, as New York City is a cosmopolitan city. And the person responded and said, well, that's because you only see it as cosmopolitan if you see white faces or black faces, because we seem to make these divisions in the United States by race. But in the city of Shanghai, the number of Koreans, the number of Taiwanese, the number of Japanese, the number of Malaysians, the number of Filipinos, as well as the number of people from all over this vast country we call China, which in many respects is like Europe in many respects, indeed is a very, very cosmopolitan city. Let's take this number, 125 million here, and just drill down a little bit. Now, if we look at this, we see here that of those 125 million visitors to China that are counted going through turnstiles, that about 74 million of them came from Hong Kong, counted as visitors. They're not from Hong Kong, there's about 2.5 million of them have come from Macau. Now, we know that Hong Kong has a population of about 7 million. Some of these are going 10 times a year. Actually, some of them are going 300 times a year, literally, and being counted. There's a lot of traffic back and forth. They are not necessarily visitors, tourists in the sense of being visitors. Some of them actually are residents living back and forth across the border. Many of them, of course, are business people, and some of them are people who are doing consulting. A good number of them are doing touring. And the like. But then if we look at South Korea, Japan, Russia, the USA, and Malaysia, we see, especially with those Asian countries, that the number of visitors relative to their populations are really quite high. In other words, this is, I guess, for many people, China is for many people living in Asia as, say, continental Europe historically was for the English, or even Americans going to England or continental Europe. It's a short flight, an hour flight, a two-hour flight, a three-hour flight, with food that's familiar and easy to eat, a culture that they're more or less familiar with. It's really quite reasonable to think that a good number of the tourist counts in China are having to do with visitors from adjacent areas of East and Southeast Asia, and that Russians, this always comes as a surprise to me, although I have found, especially in small towns in China, running across groups of Russians. Early on, I have not run into lots of Russians in my travels, but I would say the last couple years, every time you turn around, there's a Russian group. And if you're in a city, it's the Russian prostitutes, you know, that are well known in many of these cities as well. And that, you know, the tourism that comes from the USA, the UK, Australia, Germany, Canada, this relative to their population is not really all that high. The tourism from the United States continues to increase, but it's not carrying the water for the tourism industry, really, in China. Now, travel, visitors, tourists, however you want to call them, if you take some of these numbers and you see in 2006 that there were something over 76 million who crossed the border from Hong Kong and Macau, and another 50 million, we'll call them foreigners, Asian foreigners, North American foreigners, Australian, European foreigners, typically African foreigners, or South American foreigners don't add up to a great deal of this number. But the kicker comes when you see that the so-called domestic visitors, domestic tourists, which, where did this number come from? I don't know. But 1,212,000,000 people, four times the population of the United States, is literally touring in China, or so it seems. Now, I will tell you, however, that even in many of these fairly remote villages today, the machinery they had in place for selling as well as collecting tickets and then counting receipts is really quite advanced. Just like the bus stations in small towns, they make Port Authority in New York look as if it's in the, the previous century in the way we sell tickets and account for money. This has all become very well developed in many, many areas of China today. But domestic tourism is booming in China. This gives you a little picture of it as well. Note here that on this figure, there is no 1987, when I first had some sense that something was happening as far as domestic tourism is concerned. But they start here in 1991 and carry us through to 2006. Now, there are a couple things to look at in this figure here. And one is that period from 1992 to 1993. In that time, there was an upward movement of about 150%. I mean, that's significant, a significant increase. And there are people who ask why. And about the only way that we can sort of give an impetus for this, in 1979, Deng Xiaoping enunciated his opening and reform motion that the economy was going to change. Of course, much of that was to be driven by entrepreneurship of all sorts. And in China, this meant that restaurants began to open in increasing numbers, inns began to open in increasing numbers. People began to think of new ways to make money. And of course, the slogan at that particular time, not so much in 1979, but in 1982, Deng took his famous southern tour, just as the great Qing emperors did. He went south to Shenzhen, Zhuhai, the SEZs there. A little later, he went to Shanghai, and he made this great proclamation, to get rich is glorious. I mean, he's famous. That's one of the great slogans that's attributed to Deng. Not only to get rich is glorious, but it became really quite clear soon after in China, to spend money was glorious. I think the Chinese I will say, for the first time, began to think as many of us have been led and have learned, and that is the driver in our own economy is consumerism. If Americans quit buying, spending, and the like, this would have a great impact on our economy. And if we didn't travel, if we didn't buy things that have built-in planned obsolescence in them that led us already to buy something newer, in effect, our economy would not be as robust, really, as it is. I mean, now I feel really timid making that kind of assertion to people who know all this stuff much better than I do. I just sort of make this stuff up as I go along. But this is the business you guys are in, really. But clearly, the consumer economy is very important. And part of that consumer economy is the consumption of sites, tourism. Now, as we can see here, there was one dip in this generally upward movement, and that was in the year 2003. The SARS scare in East Asia not only kept foreigners from traveling, but also kept Chinese at home. Chinese did not travel very much during that period, and there was a drop, actually, and no growth in that period. And then it rebounded the next year, and in the years since, tourism in China has been increasing 20 to 40% a year. That's nice growth, I think, very, 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 very clearly. Now, one of the forces that began to even further propel the upward movement at the end of the 1990s, as we moved into the new century here, had to do with the introduction of what is called the Golden Week system. The Japanese have had a Golden Week system. I have to tell you one thing about the Chinese. Especially since 1949, Chinese people basically worked. That's what they did. There was not much leisure except leisure at home. The idea of going on a vacation, for example, having a holiday, was something that was relatively alien to them. You worked, you worked, you worked. There were three national holidays that came along the year. The biggest one was the spring, so-called Spring Festival, that only in China could come in the middle of the winter. You know, think about this. January, February, the coldest time, and the Chinese are experiencing the Spring Festival. Actually, that's a post-1949 usage of the term. I think we're going to see that term dropped increasingly and go back to the New Year Festival, which can come any time, you know, and January, February is as good as any time. But the Spring Festival doesn't really make much sense as a term. But for October 1st, 1999, the Chinese authorities granted a 7-day holiday. It included 2 weekends, so it was just sort of partially generous, you know, sort of 5 working days, and, well, not everybody had Saturday off anyway, but, this whole idea to have a whole week. Well, when you begin to think, my God, I've never had a whole week, now I have a whole week. What can I do with it? Well, a couple things had already begun to happen in the preceding decade, and many of us began to experience this. Chinese did begin to tour, to travel, but they were traveling not in the way that most of us travel. Generally, they traveled with their colleagues, not with their colleagues and their wives, but a work unit, a university department, or the accounting department of some bank or whatever. They would not go on holiday, but they would have a business meeting in Las Vegas equivalent kind of thing, you know, at some resort someplace or some revolutionary site. And so people began to see places that perhaps they had only read about, and that many of those places already had begun to develop some of the facilities that made them rather attractive. And certainly they were different. So when the Golden Week system began to emerge in October 1st, 1999, literally hordes of people began to travel. And initially, as I understand it, when this was first enunciated, nobody said we're going to have 3 of these. You know, they're going to have 1. And it stimulated the economy to such a degree, those people who were interested in stimulating the economy said, we got to do this again. And so when New Year's came, which historically was a time in which people simply went home. I mean, a lot of people traveled, but you went home, beginning to think that you could travel and enjoy yourself even not at home. And then the idea was expanded to May Day as well, the other great national holiday. And very, very soon, people began to see that about 150 million people were on the road, riding the trains, the buses, the airplanes, and of course people began to complain as well. You couldn't buy a ticket when you got to the train station. They overbooked. Everything was crowded, everything was dirty, you know, all the things that would really, really, really come with this. And more people began to say, I'm staying home. But actually, the statistics that I've seen here basically said, even from the beginning, about 50%+ of the people stayed home anyway. I mean, there are many of us, if we know that everybody else is, so-called everybody else is traveling, we are not going to travel. But we'll try to find some other time to travel. This began to happen increasingly in China. Well, this is the one you were at, I guess, in Shaanxi province, the Chaozhaonan, the Chaozha Daiyuan. I first went there in the middle 80s, and it was me and a couple other folks there. Actually, I was with a group of Chinese architects who were there. But this is what it's pretty much like today, almost round the clock.
Except the Raise the Red Lantern?
That's the Raise the Red Lantern site. I tell people always, you actually can find a time at almost any of these sites in which there's nobody around. Go early in the day, go at lunchtime, or go in the early evening. You know, the people come, swarm, you know, according to the clock, all there at once, they all leave, they all come back about the same time. But you can get out of their rhythm, typically, by just put this in here parenthetically, most of these sites today are nearby, there are local inns. So you literally can stay in a local inn and be there early in the day or later in the day, which is really the best time to enjoy China anyway.
And different seasons. We were there.
And different seasons.
In April, we were not nearly as many.
Yeah. Not, you said not nearly as many?
Not so many people.
Not too many people. Okay. April's another good time to travel. Pardon me? This is a summer picture. These are not my picture. These are Xinhua pictures, as is shown there. But I cannot imagine enjoying this place under those circumstances.
There was hardly anybody there. Right?
Pardon me?
There was hardly anybody there when I went.
What time of the year was that?
October.
Oh, my goodness, okay. I would have expected lots of people there in October.
Well, it was 12 years ago.
12 years ago? Well, there's a difference. Okay. These places have all been discovered. In fact, I'm probably going to talk about this a little bit later, and the talk is becoming more informal. I'm getting away from my notes here. But Chinese spend a great deal of their time sort of charting out where they're going to go next. And there's not only a plethora of books that are out there. If you go into any bus station, any airport, there are huge sections that deal with, you know, the places to visit that nobody else has been to, you know, in Guangdong or Fujian. There's a whole series of these. This one here is 100 old towns, for example. I have about three or four different ones of these that just show all this wonderful, enticing places, that some of which are already overwhelmed, many of them are not yet. Overwhelmed, but as we'll see in some of the other slides, that much of this is now being done by websites. I do not know. I do not know a village in China that doesn't have a website. I tell you, most even non-tourist oriented towns, some villages in China have websites. Anybody that wants to track a tourist not only has a website, it's a website that is a very busy website. Things move across here, move up, you know. And some of you who have new computer systems that warn you when you are trying to connect with a bad site. You know, this is bad, don't go there. Many of these are those sorts of things. I mean, China, we just saw recently, I guess in the Times, where they said about 40% of the sites in the world that are mall sites, bad sites, are in China. This is by and large because the Chinese don't have the level of sophistication yet in terms of semantic antivirus in their systems and the like, so they're just filled with all types of viruses. And probably many of these you don't want to go to unless you're using a university computer. Your home computer. But these are very enticing websites in China today, all over China. I saw somebody's hand up out here. Yes.
How is the resettlement from the rural areas to populous areas affected? Is that increasing this or?
Good question. And actually, it's a complicated question. Many of the villages are less crowded than they would be otherwise. So the people who are left back in the villages, the old women, the young kids, pregnant women, and the like, many of them are engaged in the tourism industry, making cash. They're maintaining their homes and then receiving money that's being sent in from the sojourners who go to the cities. There have been a couple cases that I know of. One, I guess it was in the middle 90s, I was with a group of Chinese architects and we were visiting an area that none of them had ever visited either, in Guangdong province, beautiful old architecture, Hakka architecture that had not yet been documented. And the villages were just filled with, the buildings were just filled with people, and there was beautiful ornamentation there. New paperwork, calligraphy, paintings, just everywhere. That was soon after the New Year. And I was very impressed by it, and I was taking pictures of it, feeling that I was documenting Cantonese Guangdong style, Southern style ornamentation. And then as we got to talk with people, we were quickly learned that actually all of the people who originally had been residents there had all moved to a town someplace, and they had rented their residences and their land to people from Hunan who had come down. And so everything you were seeing was Hunan ornamentation, and all the people that you were encountering were all Hunanese, all outlanders, all of the habits were from another province. But this is kind of movement, real movement that's taking place all over China. A place I visited last November in the northern part of Guangxi province, maybe you've been to Guilin in the southern part. The northern part is even more spectacular, but it was very difficult to get to, and now, of course, they're cutting big roads through their highways through there. But up there, there are some, in the northern part of Guangxi province, like in eastern Yunnan province and southern Guizhou province, there are some of the most beautiful rice terraces found anywhere in the world. You see them in some new books that are coming out. Unbelievable vertical assemblages of these rice terraces, literally sculpted over hundreds of years and maintained by people who were living there. With the arrival of tourists, more of the people are spending time catering to the tourists than maintaining the rice fields that really demand lots of maintenance in the so-called slack season, in the winter time and the like. That's one part of the picture. And then somebody else has begun to do some measuring there, and all of these tourists who come are consuming water. And because they're consuming water, there's really not enough water in the water table there, basically to keep the fields filled with water, when they have to be filled with water as well to keep the tourists filled with water. So the local ecology is beginning to break down. So, you know, what's the answer to this? It'll probably bring some poorer people from some other area of China in to do the low-level maintenance that needs to be done to keep the industry going.
How about the tourists going in the off-season to maintain the fields?
Now, I will tell you, there actually is a little bit of this taking place. Earthwatch, for example, an organization that sends expeditions around the world, you can be a paid tourist and go to places all over the world, including some places in China, and do some of that local work in terms of maintaining. I don't know about maintaining rice fields. We're watching time here. Ray told me originally I had about an hour. We're moving here. Not as fast as I'd like, but let me just move on here to a few more things as far as Anhui province is concerned. And I can show you these fairly quickly. Anhui, as you can see here, is west of Shanghai, squeezed into a little nook there. Back to my original tickets here. This is what I encountered in 1987, just a man sitting near a pool table under a big tree on the backside of Hongtun here. I was attracted to the region mainly because of its absolutely exquisite scenery, its beautiful villages, this mixture of lakes, rivers, and mountains, and almost anywhere you turn, beautiful sights. And I'm very much interested in vernacular architecture and unbelievable structures. This is the Ming Dynasty structure. I just happened to get off the bus. We stopped the bus. When I went there in 1987, it was a 12-hour trip from Hangzhou, local bus, over the mountains, over here, and we stopped here so everybody could use a wall to take a leak. That was the only reason we stopped there. And I took a picture of this house because I found it interesting, peeked on the inside, got no pictures on the inside. 10 years later, an architecture friend gave me a drawing of it. He said it was a Ming. It was a Ming house. It's still there. I've been there several times. Most people who know this area know it because of Huangshan, which is really one of the most beautiful mountainous areas in China. Now, Huangshan is as tourism began to develop in this area, the local authorities said that Huangshan was really why anybody would go to the area. And so they actually changed the name of the city there called Tunxi to Huangshan. And so you went into the Huangshan airport, stayed in the Huangshan town. Everything was really all about Huangshan. It got you very quickly up into the mountains, you did your mountain bit, you got back in your bus or your airplane and headed out. Very little attention to anything else in the area. Slowly, however, some who came began to realize there were these places that were beginning to attract tourists that made staying in the Huangshan area important and worthwhile. Places such as this, which actually got a little bit of notoriety in the year 2000. Anybody recognize what movie this might be? Crouching Tiger, right? And this is Chow Yun-fat here. Just one of several movies in that particular time that had significant scenes in the villages in this particular area. Websites began to emerge after 2000. This particular website, when I first saw it, I was kind of puzzled by it. A little bit later, if I have a chance, I'll say something about it. But all of this was really in the wake of what was happening in general in China. In much of China in the 60s, things looked like this, a mosaic, a tapestry, interesting rural areas. However, by 1982, that's 25 years ago, virtually all villages in China had already undergone a planning exercise. They began to destroy their old buildings and build new buildings, new houses, new forms of architecture, new lives for people living in the rural areas. Indeed, in many areas, you saw something like this. I don't know whether this was a Ming house or a Qing house, but it's an old house. In any case, a person was given the authority to build a new house, and he just sort of built it in the middle of his old house, and eventually the old house would go by the side. This is a photograph by Nancy Berliner here. And all over rural China, just like so much of urban China today, this character began to appear. That is tear down, basically. This structure is to be torn, it is to be torn down. Kind of parallel with this, there were a number of architects and architectural students at universities in China that began to get out there and look at the heritage value of some of what was there and began to publish it. And these all had to do with the Huizhou area. These are people at Southeast University in Nanjing. These came out wonderful little books, mainly for specialists, but they led a movement towards preservation. At first, those couple villages, I mentioned Hong Sun and Shidi that I went to in 87, but then more recently a place called Chung Khan, as well as a whole bunch of others in the region, began to focus on preserving themselves through tourism in those museum-like villages, but doing it in a fairly interesting way. This is one that's not on anybody's horizon yet, but note it, you're going to hear lots about it in the next couple years. Chung Khan, there's my ticket, there's that hall. But they advertise it with Chairman Mao and a whole bunch of other people who have never been there. And this is actually what is drawing many people to these villages. These villages were the sites of TV series, movies. So people come to see this authentic stage set that's there, not to understand necessarily the culture, the history, the architecture, the ornamentation of it. This repeats itself all over China. This is one of China's grand ancestral, actually not one of, it is the grandest ancestral hall in this out of the way village there. Just give me about three more minutes.
This is in Huizhou.
In these villages, you find architecture that looks very much like this. This particular Chung Khan village, I was pointed there in 1990, 1992, and 1994 by an old man, an old architect I was traveling with in China. He's got to get to my village. It's a wonderful village. He gave me some pictures. I've used some of the pictures in some of my books, but I just never got there because there's so many villages to visit. When I finally got there in 2003, which really isn't very far, and I've been there, I guess, four times since, this house is a Yuan Dynasty house, a 13th century house. It was being used as a barn. I have pictures of the inside. I was there last year. Somebody has come in, it's being gentrified. Somebody's putting a lot of money into it to fully restore it, but it really a very exquisite structure there. Notable partially because it's so old and relatively in good shape, preserved basically because it was used as a barn. In this area, as we can see with a whole series of slides here, the villages are quite interesting, beautiful, with all types of wood, brick, stone ornamentation. In some of these, for example, there's a good deal of destruction from the Cultural Revolution, or at least the ephemera from the Cultural Revolution that's still there, and some of it simply preserved. Some of it you can still see the old slogans, those of you who read Chinese can understand these carefully, from the period. Others, great destruction, the gouging out of figurines and the adding here of, you know, the words revolution here. Beyond that, there's been some effort to open some so-called open-air village-like museums. This concept developed in Europe. We have them in the United States. I suspect you have some of these sites in Tennessee as well. They're all over the north, the northeast. They're very popular in Europe. And that is that you bring together buildings that might not survive someplace else and reassemble them as a small town or as a village or whatever. There are several of these now in the area, and this one here, Qianko, uses the slogan, to see the imperial palaces, go to Beijing, to see folk houses, go to Qianko. And they, of course, promote themselves also by their websites. They're visited to the degree, frankly, I've been told that many people who go there think they're visiting a Chinese village. In other words, it aged very, very well over the last 10 years, except it was built on a site that nobody ever would have built a village on. It's on hills and the like. But it's worked very, very well. There also has been a number of institutional efforts, principally by the Peabody Essex Museum in Massachusetts, that if you ever get to Boston, make sure you go to the Peabody Essex Museum. They have a Chinese house that was moved at the end of the 90s and restored. Have a wonderful website. It's called Yin Yutang, Y-I-N-Y-U-T-A-N-G. And also a lot of individual efforts there to restore. This particular ancestral hall in a village called Huangcun was actually supported by Ned Johnson of Fidelity Investment. Much of Chung Han was facilitated by a rich collector of Asian art, Robert Ellsworth, in New York City. So money from the West actually is flowing in to help some of the preservation. Sometimes you see a sign, sometimes you don't. Now, in these villages, there are issues very, very clearly. One is the issue of how to maintain authenticity. It may look real. There have been many cases where a place called Lijiang in Yunnan, well-known, heavily trafficked area, there was an earthquake about 3 years ago. A lot of the old buildings collapsed because of the earthquake. The local authorities decided they were going to build new buildings in an old style that had nothing to do with the buildings that were originally there. They weathered very, very quickly, so most people think that they've always been there. There's that question of authenticity there. There also is this issue of what I call crafting a master narrative. There was a time when people traveled to these villages when they were satisfied simply wandering through the village, seeing the old lady sitting here, the old men sitting there, the kids over there, wandering at the entrance and exiting to the bus on the other end. Typically, the villages didn't make very much money on this pass-through traffic. People think of ways to keep people in the villages, keep people interested in the village, and they typically craft a master narrative. There's a story that you have to be told, and it's the kind of story that some of you have heard in China when you go into a cave and see the stalactites, the stalagmites. It's all fantasy and the like. But many of these stories have nothing to do with the village at all. But it's a kind of branding. You all know about branding, right? I mean, this is what you get people to do. Create something that works. And so they brand these villages with not only a story, but also graphics, visual images. And these are not always real. There also is this issue of simply coping with increasing visitation. Every time somebody touches a wall, crosses a threshold. I can't remember when I first encountered this, but I wish I had taken a photograph. It must have been in the early 90s, going to the Forbidden City in Beijing and realizing they had already covered all the steps with bamboo slats. Because just in the preceding decade or so, so many people had gone up the steps that all of the steps had begun to wear, the stone had begun to wear away. And you didn't want to replace this historical stone, but you could replace this ahistorical bamboo. So you find this sort of thing in many, many places in China. Let me move quickly to some conclusions here. In much of China, it's the interest in these places, but it's also this newfound accessibility of them. When I mentioned in 1987, when I first went to those Guizhou villages, it was a 12-hour difficult ride. Today, these villages are accessible by a 2-plus-hour thruway-type bus from Hangzhou directly there, American-style expressways. These expressways have opened all over China. Tracy, of course, knows Shaanxi so well. That also used to be a very inaccessible place. Today has been opened widely by highways there. Chinese tourists today dominate tourism in China, coming no longer simply in buses with groups, but increasingly coming as weekend trips in their private automobiles from any big city, whether it's Beijing, Taiyuan, or whatever. And this has spawned all types of other entrepreneurial activities to cater to the individuals with their one child as they travel. Increasingly in the West, we're seeing some enticement of people to travel to some of these places, but there's not a heck of a lot of it. But if you have a chance, look at the Frommer's China Guide that has some problems with it. But in there are some sections that list what the principal author of that section, Peter Neville Hadley, calls China's best, the best mansions and palaces, the best small towns and villages, the best countryside retreats, the best temples, the best local accommodations, I mean, these are out there. You don't have to be an intrepid backpacker today to enjoy these once out of the way places. You can even get to some of these best up and coming destinations before they become too popular. In China, there's urgent need for planning and policy relating to all of these particular sites. The issues of management are a very significant one. The Chinese had not yet fully understood this notion that people, environmentalists, preservationists in the West and in Europe well understand, and that is what's generally called acceptable limits of change. There's going to be change, but how can you marshal forces to diminish the tsunami, the potential tsunami that comes from increasing tourism? I'm an optimist. I think in the years to come that more and more of these sites will be able to successfully come to terms with managing large numbers of people as they come. In the process, however, some of these sites are going to suffer somewhat irreparable damage. But those who have dealt with architectural history in China know that whether it's been war, fire, or whatever, a lot has been destroyed. And when it's been destroyed, often it's been rebuilt. And that's the story of China. So tonight, really, what I wanted to do was give you some sense of some of these issues in one small section of China. If you get beyond Shidi and Hongsun, there are still many other villages that are still not on the itineraries of the hordes that are coming, that are worth enjoying. I urge you to get out of the big cities in China and see the China that's on the margins. Thank you very much.